From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a nonpartisan idea to find enough money to fix our roads.
There's increasing recognition by legislators on both sides of the aisle that our roads cannot be neglected anymore, that this is affecting economic development, it's affecting quality of life in the state.
A demolition company accused of tearing down vacant Detroit homes, then burying the debris in the holes.
It's a big issue right now. There are a lot of concerns from residents, council members, and even environmental experts right now.
Remembering an African-American neighborhood in Lansing torn down to make way for a freeway.
You took a way of life. All the churches, all the dentist offices, all the bars, all the restaurants, all the nightclubs, my grandmother's house.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we look back to the 1960s, a neighborhood in Lansing, mainly African American, destroyed to make way for the I-496 freeway.
Everyone had to move within a very short period of time. And when we're talking everyone, we're talking more than 650 families.
Later this hour, we learn about a new effort to gather the lost history of that Lansing community. But first, no one can deny Michigan's roads are bad and getting worse. Within 6 years, the number of roads considered fair or good condition will drop below the 50% mark. Lawmakers passed that $1.2 billion road funding package in 2015, but that's fallen far short of what it's needed to get Michigan roads up to at least fair condition. The Nonpartisan Citizens Research Council of Michigan has examined all the road funding options and today came out with recommendations. Eric Lufer is the president of the CRC. So, Eric, tell us, what is the recommendation for the best way to find road repair money?
Win the lottery.
Good one.
Well, Michigan has a long history of sort of a user fee approach where we use gas tax and vehicle registration fees, and that creates some accountability. We know where the money's coming from, and we know what it's being used for. So our paper is really geared around maintaining that relationship. We could certainly look at other things, a sales tax, an income tax, things like that. But we've tended in Michigan to use those for other things like education and just funding the general fund. So we really built our paper around how do we use revenue sources that we know, that we understand, to fund the roads. And, you know, there's certainly long-term issues with that. The gas tax is not as productive over time as we would hope for because of increased fuel efficiency and hybrid cars and things like that. But we got to worry about now and then deal with the long term after we get past this short term issue.
And the thing that seems to jump out is a recommendation to untie the sales tax from gasoline sales.
Yeah, we're one of the few states in the nation that include motor fuels in the sales tax base. And that creates a lot of confusion because when you look at the overall amount of taxes that we charge at the pump, we're near the top. We were like fourth or fifth in the nation for total taxes. But more than half of that money isn't going for roads. It's going for schools and for local government, what we call state revenue sharing. So part of our recommendation is let's just untangle that. Let's have whatever taxes our state policymakers come up with to fund schools and to fund local government revenue sharing, but let's use gas taxes and let's use vehicle registration fees solely for roads. Let's not charge things for the pump that are funding anything external to the roads.
And I think the first thing people listening would want to go say is, would we see prices at the pump go up if we did that?
So you can do it in a revenue neutral way at the pump. You can say we're not going to do the sales tax anymore and we'll just replace it with gas taxes. That would be somewhere in the 15, 17, maybe 18 cents a gallon. You'd replace it, produce almost $900 million, and then you would have, of course, have to find a way to make up that money for schools and for local governments.
Yes, because that was my next question. If you do that, don't we create a problem in those other areas like schools and local revenue sharing that rely on that money from the taxes at the fuel pump? How do you fill that hole?
Back in 2015, we tried to do it with the sales tax, and the voters weren't too keen on that idea because we've built in the tax rate for sales into the Constitution. It required a vote. We don't necessarily think that's a bad idea, but we don't have the time to go for a vote on this. So I think we're looking probably at increasing property taxes at the state level, or looking at income taxes, or some of the other taxes capable of raising that amount of money.
One of the things I took away from looking at your report is the fact, you know, when we think about that, lawmakers passed that $1.2 billion package, and that was in 2015. But we know the 21st Century Infrastructure Commission figures we need $2.2 billion more every year to get roads up to at least fair condition. So when you think of the politics here, what would it take to make this idea of untying the sales tax from gasoline sales, what would it take to make that happen?
Well, I think some of the pieces are already in place. We have a champion at the state level with the governor who made this a key campaign issue. I think there's increasing recognition by legislators on both sides of the aisle that our roads cannot be neglected anymore, that this is affecting economic development, it's affecting quality of life in the state. So those pieces are in place, and now we're just thinking about how to come up with the money and how much money is sufficient to do what we need to do. You know, those are the major pieces. You have to have willing players, and you have to have somebody that keeps them in the committee room, keeps the discussion going until we can find agreement and move things forward.
Eric Lufer is president of the nonpartisan Citizens Research Council of Michigan, out with its report today evaluating Michigan's options to increase road funding. Eric, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Demolishing abandoned buildings causing blight in Detroit, that has been a priority of Mayor Duggan and the Detroit Land Bank Authority. State and local regulations require contractors to completely remove all demolition debris after they tear down a building, to cart that debris to an approved landfill, and then fill the open holes with clean, approved dirt. A Chicago demolition company that works with the Detroit Land Bank Authority is now under scrutiny for allegedly not following those rules. Detroit Free Press reporter Kat Stafford has been working on this story. Kat, who's the company and what is it accused of doing?
So this company is McDonough Demolition, Inc. As you stated, it is a Chicago-based company. This is a newer company to the Land Bank's demolition program, and this company is at risk of losing more than $15 million in scheduled demolition work after allegations surfaced that it tore down several homes and then buried the debris under dirt.
So not carting all the debris away as it's supposed to.
Correct.
And how did this come to light, Kat?
So that is an interesting part. The city told me that a city employee was the one to uncover this. The city touted its internal quality controls, but multiple sources told me that this came to light after a former employee of the company actually went to the land bank and shared some photos of the debris that was improperly placed underground. So there's a bit of a conflict right now as to how this actually was uncovered.
And you did some digging, and as we see in your report in the Free Press today, McDonough has done some 90 demolitions in Detroit since it started working here in December, and you reviewed the projects and turned up some questions about bidding awards. What did you find?
Yes. So the city has on its website an open data portal. I took that data and I went through about 80 or so records, and I found that half a dozen of these contracts that this company was awarded exceeded the $25,000 federal ceiling that has been set on these federal funds. At least two of these properties, they were set to be awarded more than $40,000 to demolish a single family home.
Okay, and what about the city's response to this scrutiny and to these accusations against McDonough?
So the city is saying that it's, you know, responding swiftly, that the company is facing severe penalties as well as potentially being kicked out of the program. But at least one city official, City Council President Pro Tem Mary Sheffield, as well as a state agency that actually oversees the city's demolition program, they are questioning why this wasn't caught sooner. So there are a lot of questions right now. The city is investigating this, but the state is demanding that the city give them a full rundown and report to explain just how this happened and why these violations weren't caught during its routine inspection process.
Kat, earlier this month, you had a big, big story about a widening federal criminal probe into Detroit's demolition program, particularly focusing on the question, was contaminated dirt used to fill these demolition holes in Detroit, even at times dead animals? Is that story separate from today's debris issue, or is there reason to believe this is all kind of connected?
That is a great question. You know, that report actually came out just 2 weeks ago, so this kind of is a follow-up story to that, because concerns are being raised yet again. Is the city doing enough to monitor its backfill procedures? Is there a strong enough backfill policy in place to prevent instances like this from happening? You know, that first story was really looking at, you know, where did contractors get the dirt from? And now the second story is saying, okay, who's monitoring the dirt once these contractors come to fill the holes? So it's a big issue right now. There are a lot of concerns from residents, council members, and even environmental experts right now.
In fact, in your story, you quote City Council President Pro Tem Mary Sheffield. What does she want to have happen as these reports build? What's she calling for?
So Council President Pro Tem Mary Sheffield, in my story today, she is calling for the company's contracts to be pulled, but more significantly, she is calling for the city to have control over the demolition program again. Right now, the program is under the oversight of the Detroit Building Authority and the Detroit Land Bank Authority, and Sheffield is saying that she believes the city needs to be overseeing this directly because of all of these recurring instances that I've been reporting as well as others. She's also calling for the company's wrecking license to be revoked and for the company to essentially be banned from doing business in the city. So there's a lot happening right now.
And what are you going to be most closely watching, Kat Stafford?
Oh, as this investigation heats up, I am watching to see what's next, what the feds are looking at, and I'm going to be keeping a watchful eye on this process. You know, I'm getting a lot of tips right now from concerned residents, so there will be more to come.
Detroit Free Press reporter Kat Stafford. Thanks so much, Kat.
Thank you.
Coming up, legal troubles mount for a prominent opera singer and University of Michigan professor who's accused of raping a fan. More on that story in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time for Theater Talk as we check out professional theater around Michigan with David Kiley of Encore Michigan. And we begin at Detroit's Fisher Theater.
Yeah, first up, Cynthia, is The Lightning Thief. This show is adapted, of course, from the books about Percy Jackson, and these books are written by Rick Riordan. Percy is a young man who finds out not only that Greek gods are real, but that he is, in fact, the offspring of Poseidon. I don't know if you've read them or—
Never heard of them. That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, yeah. They're very popular with young people. And anyway, as such, he finds he has new powers, which are going to come in handy because he's got monsters on his trail and he's on this epic quest to find Zeus's lightning bolt and prevent a war from breaking out among all the Greek gods.
Okay.
Anyway, it's very popular among young people. It's at the Fisher this week. There have been a couple of attempts to convert these books and the story to films, to be precise. Neither one considered very good,
and
actually.
I think that's where I've heard of them,
yeah,
is
yeah.
These films that, eh.
And they were not critically, you know, well-received at all. However, this stage production, which opens this week, so I haven't seen it yet, but it's been getting very good notices, and it runs through March 9th, opens this week. Our reviewer is going to see it this week. But again, from what I can tell, I think those who like the books are going to like this show.
And then just asking for someone who has not heard of it, can someone go, do you think, and be able to enjoy it without having known about the books?
You know what? Some of the reviews that I've read said it helps if you have read the books. However, if you haven't read the books, read up on it, you know, kind of online. So you kind of get the gist of it before you go.
And when we say young people, are we talking little ones or maybe more teenager, young adult?
You know,
readers?
It's really anything from 18 to 16, you know,
okay.
Really,
yeah.
I think. And then, of course, you've got adults who read them when they came out.
Sure.
So they're going to be interested. So,
all yeah. right. So that's The Lightning Thief opening at the Fisher and running through March 9th. And then we head north on Woodward to Ferndale and the Ringwald, where they're kind of changing gears from their usual offbeat zany offerings.
Yeah. So once in a while, the Ringwald, which is known for their parody shows and cross-dressing, mm-hmm. things like that often.
Yeah.
Occasionally, they drop in a classic. A few years ago, it was Streetcar Named Desire. This past weekend, actually opened last week, Death of a Salesman, the classic by Arthur Miller. And our reviewer said it was wonderful, but they do a really good job. Joe Bailey's the director. He's also one of the co-owners of the theater, and he's incredibly talented as an actor and a director. So I have personal high hopes, but our reviewer says she was really affected by their production.
And it's a great intimate space.
Very intimate. It takes place, the production actually kind of wanders around the space, I'm told, sort of in the aisles. And, you know, it's because it's a storefront theater. So seeing a classic like that in that kind of, I love these small theaters. I really do. These where there's like 50 people can fit in there. It's
well,
such a different experience.
It's accessible. And if they're right in front of you, yeah. it pulls you in as an audience member.
Actors are feet away from you. It's yeah. amazing.
Next up, we have two theaters opening the very same show on the very same night.
Yeah, it's unusual. This is the Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. And it was very popular on Broadway, very popular in the West End. It came through touring in the last couple of years to Fisher and Wharton, I think. So now it's open for all the other regional theaters to do. And Farmer's Alley in Kalamazoo and Open Book in Trenton are both opening it on the same night. Now, these two theaters are 100-some miles apart, so they're not really in conflict. And this is the story of a young man who has Asperger's. And there is an incident where the dog was killed in the night, and he's initially accused of it. But he's released because he didn't do it, and now he investigates. And he learns a lot about his parents. He learns a lot about the people who live on his block who he's never met. And it's a very interesting show, has a huge following. It started out as a book, and the book and the play have huge followings.
And you say that particularly people who have loved ones on the autism spectrum really love this play.
They do, because it seems to so well capture in his character what life is really like for people with Asperger's and people who are on the spectrum.
Now we head to the Slipstream Theater Initiative, heading back to Ferndale and a show called Wolves. What is this one about? I don't think I've heard of it.
Yeah, this play actually won a Pulitzer, and it's becoming very popular. In fact, the Flint Repertory Theater just did it. And so it's about female soccer players. And it's kind of their interactions about, you know, it's I wouldn't call it a woman's play, you know, so much, because I have seen it. I liked it a lot. It's a very intimate play, because it's really about women athletes relating to one another and really exploring their life together and the competitive nature of it. And it's very well written, really well written.
Very good. All right. So that will be at the Slipstream Theater Initiative in Ferndale. And you wanted to talk about an especially user-friendly offering coming up this spring at the Michigan Opera Theater.
Yeah. Well, it opens March 9th. It is the first of two spring operas from the Michigan Opera Theater. This one's actually not at the Detroit Opera House. It's at the Macomb Center for Performing Arts.
All right, so on Garfield at M59.
Correct. Yeah. And it's Candide. And this is based on the original Voltaire novel. It's a very friendly opera to people who are not huge opera fanatics, would appreciate opera, like to get the fur wrap out once a year to go. But it features a love story. It's a war between European countries. It's satire. It's got Voltaire's philosophy mixed in. It's a very fun piece. The music is by Leonard Bernstein.
There you go.
And The opera itself has an interesting history, I think, because when it was originally done in the 50s, the libretto was by Lillian Hellman. Her libretto was not considered that good. Hal Prince got his hands on it later. The Bernstein music is still intact, but now it gets performed with a libretto written by Hugh Wheeler, which is considered a much better libretto. And a nice thing about this production is that it features Michigan Opera Theater's own studio artist. So no big out-of-town opera stars dropping in for this.
All right. Well, let's take a listen to some of the opera from the MOT production with that wonderful music by Leonard Bernstein.
Let us review Lesson 11.
Paragraph 2, Axiom 7.
Once one dismisses the rest of all possible worlds, one finds that this is the best of all possible worlds.
Once one dismisses the rest of all possible worlds, one finds that this is the best of all possible worlds.
All right, well, we've got a busy kind of wrap-up of winter looking into spring. And as always, you can find details on all of these productions by going to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, thank you.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Legal troubles continue to mount for a prominent opera singer and tenured U of M professor accused of sexual misconduct and rape. David Daniels faces extradition to Texas to be tried in the 2010 sexual assault of a young graduate student in Houston. His husband, Scott Walters, is also charged. And Daniels has been subject to many complaints of soliciting students for sex over social media. And the firestorm of complaints is extending to the University of Michigan. Gus Burns of M Live is here to sort through this very complex story for us. Gus, let's start by briefly telling us what happened in that 2010 incident in Texas with this young man named Samuel Schultz.
What we understand from police reports that came to us from the University of Michigan, from interviews with Daniels and Walters, they claim that they had an encounter with Samuel Schultz, who at the time was a graduate student at Rice University, and he was kind of, they say, a fan. And at the time, Daniels was performing in a play. And then on the final night of the cast party, they invited Samuel Schultz over. And then that's where the stories sort of diverge. Schultz, what he's reported through media and to police, says that it led to him being drugged and sexually assaulted or essentially raped by the couple, and he woke up the next day not knowing what had happened. And if you take their story, they present it as a casual encounter and say that Schultz had no problem the following day when he woke up, and then they didn't hear anything about it for days, and then Schultz just cut off contact with them, and then they didn't hear anything much more about it other than rumors that he was telling people that he had been sexually assaulted for the next 8 years. And then this came up in the summer when he went public, inspired apparently somewhat by the Me Too movement.
So it took some time for him to step forward and for complaints to be leveled. Meantime, in 2015, University of Michigan hires David Daniels. Tell us the sense of complaints students have been lodging against him.
There really were no complaints that came out until the first thing said about them and possible sexual misconduct by Daniels was in March of 2018. When someone was forced to report that they had heard rumors of two anonymous students who claimed that they had been approached by Daniels using the phone application Grindr, which is kind of a hookup app, and as they started having conversations with them, at least the student from, this actually happened in February of 2017, he said that he was having conversation. As the conversation proceeded, he found out that this was a professor in the same school that he was studying in, and there was an acknowledgement on both sides that they knew who each other were, and Daniels requested that they have some sort of a sexual encounter for $300, and that's according to screenshots of text messages that made their way to police, originally with the U of M police, but then got forwarded on to other departments.
Is this Andrew Lippian we're talking about? Because that lawsuit, there's a sexual harassment and discrimination lawsuit filed against Daniels by a former student named Andrew Lippian. What does he say happened?
Well, that also happened in the same time, but this is separate from the Grindr complaint, as far as I'm aware. There are two people reporting. Andrew Lippian says something sort of similar to what is alleged in the 2010 case. He says that he was invited over to Daniel's house, and this was in a lawsuit that's since been dismissed against Daniel's, but he said he was invited over to Daniel's house. While he was there, he was presented as being tricked into having an Ambien sleeping pill that he was told was Tylenol PM, and then there proceeded to be some sexual assault after that.
And I know, as you write, that David Daniels filed a countersuit against Lipien, right, for invasion of privacy and emotional distress. So there's all kinds of ricocheting legal actions, a lot building up, and this criminal rape trial pending in Texas because he was arrested, as was his husband, in Michigan on the Texas charges?
Correct. I think that they were arrested at the very end of January. Since then, they've been down there to court, and I think the next court date for them is April 15th. In Harris County, where Houston, Texas is, where he's accused of the crime, they have released them on a bond. They're allowed to travel within Washtenaw County and contiguous counties. According to the campus, they're not allowed to deal with anyone at this time on the Michigan campus, or not allowed to visit the campus, too.
Well, as this is all built up then, how has the University of Michigan responded, particularly in ways that are now drawing criticism?
As far as their dealings with MLive, they have not necessarily been that open about details, and they base that on their own policies of privacy protection for students, as well as their policy not to release detailed personnel decisions or details related to discipline against professors. So the most information we got from the University of Michigan actually did not come from them. The Grindr case from February of 2017 was forwarded to Pittsfield Police, which is a township next to Ann Arbor, because the complainant was from Pittsfield. So then Pittsfield did a solicitation investigation to see if there was anything illegal with Daniels offering $300 to him for sex. And they determined there was nothing that they could pursue criminally, but we proceeded to follow up with a records request to Pittsfield, and then that unveiled the original U of M investigation.
So what happened out of that investigation? So you say that they've been told to stay away from campus?
This is separately. This is from the Public Relations Department at the University of Michigan. At first, it wasn't clear whether it was kind of a voluntary leave due to all the firestorm that was going on, or he was asked to take a paid leave, because Daniels is on paid leave right now. And the university now says that they placed him on leave, indicating that it was kind of a forced leave, and that they said that he's also been instructed not to talk to students or visit the campus.
But it's worth noting that he is still being paid. He is still on the payroll.
Yeah, I believe the figure that we saw when he was hired, it was about $191,000. I don't know if that's changed in the last couple of years, but that's what it was originally.
As the headline in your most recent story, University of Michigan denies mishandling sexual misconduct claims. So who's denying the mishandling?
The attorney hired by the University of Michigan has filed a response to the complaint that was originally filed by Andrew Lipien, who's claiming the sexual assault in 2017. They're basically doing what you would expect in response to a federal lawsuit. They're not admitting to anything, but they are saying in certain cases that they did follow through with the proper investigative process. And as far as being presented with things such as the text messages that the police came up with and that were forwarded to Pittsfield, that seemed to be evidence that he did commit some sort of misconduct in relation to at least one student. In their formal response to the lawsuit, they're claiming that they have followed through with their normal investigative procedures related to their Office of Institutional Equity, which investigates any on-campus misconduct claims, and essentially just have denied any claims made by Lipien that they did not follow through with proper procedures. There's a couple different ways they've done that, and one is they're sort of seems to be blaming Lipien because he did not cooperate after he filed the lawsuit and after the university became aware of his claims. He and his attorney, they say in the lawsuit, have refused to cooperate, so they haven't been able to fully investigate some of the claims he made.
Have you heard from students? Have you heard from parents of students at the School of Music, Theater, and Dance?
Not really. I mean, I've spoken with one of the complainants in the Grindr case, and Daniels was very popular and well-liked, and I had wondered if any of this that has come out has changed that. I assumed that maybe he would still have a good number of supporters, and that student said that's not the case, that there has been kind of a big shift, and he's not receiving nearly the support as he did when this first started to come out.
So what comes next? What are you watching for, Gus?
Obviously, we're trying to figure out what's going to happen with the criminal case, and nothing's going to happen with that for a couple months. The federal lawsuit can drag out for a long time, but it's just a matter of seeing when the next paperwork comes through, the next filing comes through to see if there's any new information. We've got several FOIAs in with the University of Michigan for different communications related to the internal OIE, Office of Institutional Equity investigations. We've been keeping tabs with one of the complainants in the Grindr claim, trying to see if their sexual misconduct claim has been completed, which as of a week ago, it had not been. And then I guess the last thing is to see if Lipien actually follows through with what his attorney indicated they were, and that would be that they're going to file the same portion of that federal lawsuit is going to be shifted over to the state courts in the civil realm. So they were going to file a new lawsuit against Daniels in state court.
A lot to try to parse through, particularly a lot of legal actions in this case of University of Michigan opera professor David Daniels. And we've been talking with M Live reporter Gus Burns. Thank you so much, Gus.
Thank you.
Coming up, the federal government called it urban renewal. What it really often meant was the displacement of people in mainly black neighborhoods to make way for new infrastructure like freeways. And the city of Lansing was no exception.
As early as 1956, they had selected 80 cities that would be targeted for an expressway. Lansing was one of them. Black Bottom in Detroit was one of them. Almost every major city was selected for a highway.
The legacy of Lansing's 496 bypass. That's after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. They called it urban renewal, clearing away long-standing neighborhoods to make way for a great big new freeway. But those neighborhoods demolished for freeways in the 1950s and the 1960s were often the heart of a city's black community. So homes were lost, businesses, churches lost, and hundreds of people would have to move out and find a new place to live. That's what happened in Lansing in the 1960s. The Historical Society of Greater Lansing is now focusing on the history of that black neighborhood lost to I-496 with a project it calls Paving the Way. With us is Bill Castanier, president of the Historical Society of Greater Lansing, and Adolph Burton, a lifelong Lansing resident. He lived in the neighborhood demolished to make way for the freeway. It's a pleasure to welcome both of you to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Adolph, start by, if you would, describe the neighborhood, the community that was displaced by this freeway. I guess take us on a walk down Main Street or St. Joseph Street.
Yes, I can do that. Well, originally I was born on Olds Avenue, which is approximately two or three blocks from St. Joe Street. And we moved because Oldsmobile purchased our home, and then we got in the I-496 corridor. Now, in that neighborhood was our local dentist, our doctor, where we purchased our groceries. My grandmother's house is right about three blocks away, as well as the church we all went to. So it was a neighborhood that was pretty self-sufficient.
And so everything was there, and I imagine you had large family constellations in the neighborhood.
Yes, we did. That's correct.
And when the I-496 project was announced, can you remember the community's response to the fact that basically what? People were told this neighborhood's going away.
Well, at that time, I was about 16 or 17 years old, and I wasn't really into politics that much and was being a 16 or 17-year-old, you know, just getting in high school. So I wasn't really attuned to that too much. But as I look back now and think about that, a lot of people were just kind of passive to it and was accepting of it. And then there were others who were pretty much an uproar about it. So it was kind of mixed emotions. I would say probably 60 or 70% of the people were kind of going along with it.
Bill, as the president of the Historical Society of Greater Lansing, give us a little bit of context here as far as why this decision was made, and particularly how it came to be that people were just moved out of their homes.
Okay, the highway history in our country goes back at least to the 1880s, actually.
Sure.
I don't think we want to go back that far. But in the 50s, there was a move nationwide to build expressways, or divided highways, as they were often referred to. And it was led by President Eisenhower. So as early as 1956, they had selected 80 cities that would be targeted for an expressway. Lansing was one of them. Black Bottom in Detroit was one of them. Almost every major city was selected for a highway. The two most notable ones that decided not to do this were San Francisco and New Orleans. They just said no after much disagreement. But one of the attractions to it was the federal government paid 90% of the cost. 10% was paid generally by the state, and the city of Lansing, for example, spent less than $500,000 to have an expressway through the center of its city.
So if you were at all inclined to want to have that easy transportation and you were in city government, this was served up on a silver platter.
Oh, it was. And city planners loved this idea. They thought they could do some social engineering. At the time, the areas they went through were either called slums or ghettos. And those were the words they used. And they thought by eliminating slums and ghettos, they could accomplish two things. They could make it easy to get from one end of the city to the other and move people throughout the city, then disperse people.
And just to kind of break it down quickly, dislocating these neighborhoods, paving them over, putting in the freeways, break down briefly the chain of events then that really wound up sending white people to the suburbs.
Exactly. When they first decided to instigate the expressway system, they thought this will bring people into the city. Well, what most planners forgot is it also took them out very easily. It takes 7 minutes to go from one end of Lansing to the other. 7 minutes, that's all, on a snowy day. So what it did is everyone had to move within a very short period of time. And when we're talking everyone, we're talking more than 650 families that were in the black neighborhood. So once their home was purchased, they had 45 days to vacate that home. It actually created a tremendous turmoil in Lansing. First, there was a housing shortage. And secondly, blacks could not live everywhere yet. So that didn't happen at least until 68 and probably into the 70s.
Right.
So 650 families had to be located almost overnight, and that was a tremendous problem within the city. Once they moved, they triggered white flight in many neighborhoods. First black family to live in a neighborhood, white families started selling. And so by default, Lansing became desegregated. It wasn't pleasant at the time, wasn't pretty. There was a lot of difficulty making those relocations happen.
Where did you go? What did your family do when your house is sold? It's stunning to stop and think. For over 650 families, you had to be out in 45 days.
Well, I tell you, most of the people in our neighborhood moved to the south side of town where a new housing project was already under development. I would say, I don't know, maybe 60 or 70, maybe even 80% of the people went there. But what my family did, my dad and my mom, purchased one of the homes that was getting torn down by the I-496 project right down the block, purchased a lot across the street at the north side of 496, dug a hole, and put the house on that. So we just moved right across the street. And the house is still there today, as a matter of fact.
Still
there. My sister
still
lives there.
Oh, my goodness. Bill, why this project now? Where'd the push come from to do paving the way?
Well, I think it came from the Historical Society's recognition that this is an untold story. This is a neighborhood. Everybody identifies with neighborhoods. And no one really outside the black community knew about this neighborhood anymore. It's been 50 years almost. You can drive down the expressway, tens of thousands of people do, and you don't think of what was under it or over it. And we wanted to tell a story of a time and a place that is totally gone. If you probably go back to your neighborhood and it's still there. The people that live there go back to that neighborhood and it's pretty hard to point out, except for Adolf, where they lived. You know, it's gone,
it's
totally
gone.
But the stories aren't gone.
And the stories aren't gone. And here we have this project, Paving the Way, research project, and so many ways you're going to do this, including oral histories. And I know, Adolf, you've been involved in that. Tell us what that was like for you.
Well, I tell you, it's very interesting as well because, as I said, I was only like 15 or 16, 17 at the time. So I'm learning quite a bit myself and a lot of interesting stories about places that I was a little bit too young to go to, like some of the nightclubs and restaurants that serve liquor. And so I'm hearing about those, as well as some of the people that were not so attuned to the move were very rebellious and very militant about that. I was very surprised at that, too, and they were saying that it might have been redlining and some political issues as well. So I'm learning quite a bit myself.
Bill, when you stop and explain to us how quickly the city went in and raised this neighborhood after announcing the project and just, you know, buying the houses, what challenges does that present for building this archive and this documentation?
Well, one of the things is when you move from a house, you leave a lot behind or you don't take it. And so some of the history is gone, but it's surprising how much was saved. Now, we're at an age where people have not lived to see what we're doing. So we're right at the cusp of losing a lot of people, and so it's really important we get this done in the next year or so. But I think there's enough stories that are oral traditions that still are out there that we're gonna grab that'll be there forever, we hope. And, you know, 50 years from now, somebody can say, I can go and find out what it was like to have lived there. One of the things we're finding out is the neighborhood was self-contained, but it was a great place to live. And they weren't slums and they weren't ghettos.
In fact, I'm interested in taking you into what you're learning as you see this lost neighborhood through the eyes of the people who lived there, Bill. What has surprised you the most?
Well, one of the things that surprised me, and I lived in Lansing during that period of time, so I understood what was going on. But for example...
But you were on the outside looking in.
I was an outsider looking in, and one of the things I learned very quickly was there were 8 churches there that were torn down. That was the center of the community. But one of the churches was, the pastor was the uncle of Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King preached at least twice in that church. I did not know that. I don't think very many people outside that neighborhood knew that. That's a phenomenal thing. We also just recently learned there was maybe a half dozen homes and businesses that operated as boarding rooms that were in the Green Book. So we're learning stories, and we're going to be able to carry them on for a long time. I learned that there was a pretty famous jazz musician, Big Nick Nicholas, who was famous enough that Coltrane wrote a song about him called Big Nick. There's stories like that that go on forever, and thanks to people like Adolf, who knows everybody in the community. That's the other thing. Everybody knows each other. So if you talk to one, they'll say, you need to talk to this person. And without Adolf, we wouldn't be doing this.
And isn't it fascinating that we're hearing this? We've certainly we've heard this story repeated from Flint. I've had conversations with someone who lived in a neighborhood that was totally gone to make way for an oil plant and its parking lot. You pointed to the Black Bottom neighborhood in Detroit, gone for I-375. And now we're hearing kind of a sense that maybe these freeways weren't so good for our cities. We're cut off. People can't walk around. People can't do the things they want to do in 2019 because there's a great big ribbon of moving concrete in front of them.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things that's happening around the country, I think Atlanta might be one of the first places it's happening, is they're building ramps across them, reconnecting the neighborhoods. There were 35 streets dead-ended in Lansing. So on either side of those streets, neighborhoods were gone also, not just in the Black neighborhood, but 35 streets. They're noisy. Lansing, interestingly, is not elevated in any way, so that's probably good. It goes 20 feet under grade in some areas, but what happened is that created a funnel where noise just came out of it like a speaker. So they're not pleasant to live next to.
Was there a new bill just passed to change the one-way streets coming up part of this time this year?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, thank you.
What's that? Tell us about that.
The mayor of Lansing, new mayor, decided that he had enough of one-way streets in Lansing. We had probably a dozen one-way streets. He's changing seven of them back to two-way streets. The one-way streets were created for off and on ramps.
So that's at least some reverse engineering, we should say.
There's a reverse engineering.
We'll forget how to get around.
Tell us what will be in paving the way. What are some of the components of this project?
Well, we're doing the oral histories. They're going to be both video and audio. We're going to do at least 50. We may do up to 100. We're going to create an online interactive map. Ours will be online. You'll be able to click on an address or a house, see what the house looked like, see who lived there, and then see where they moved. Attached to some of those will be oral histories about that house or the business or whatever. We're also going to local churches and gathering ephemera and photographs and scanning them because we want to do a temporary exhibit in the Library of Michigan for probably a month or 6 weeks. And then what we'll do is we'll take it on the road. We're going to have a traveling exhibit. And we're actually creating what is referred to in history now as a lost archive for that neighborhood. And that'll be available in a scrapbook form online and in print. But we're finding things like the day after we announced it, somebody came with a 97-page scrapbook for us of the history. So those things are out there. We discovered one of the most surprising things we discovered, and Luther can mention, Adolf can mention it a little bit, is his father was a photographer. He has tens of thousands of images from that neighborhood. It's absolutely amazing, and he's hung on to them. So we're going to be able to scan those, put those in an archive so people can see it forever.
A historian's gold mine. Adolf, tell me how that feels to, here we are 50 years some later from when this all happened, and to have this spotlight back on your neighborhood. Mm-hmm. How does that feel?
Well, I tell you, it's a really wonderful feeling because, as Bill said, my stepdad just passed away about 18 months ago. And we had lots and lots of family pictures as well as pictures that he took of weddings and other events that took place in our community. And we just didn't know what to do with them. So a friend of mine, Derek Quinney, introduced me to Bill, who was working on the project, and we kind of got a marriage going there. And a lot of the pictures are, some of them are posed, but the best ones are the ones that are not posed, where my dad just took candid pictures of people. And some of them are some of the first black doctors in our city, dentists, lawyers. And so they're really, really, really nice pictures of them when they're in their 20s, just graduating from Michigan State. So they're really nice pictures, and I'm really enjoying them. My dad would really appreciate that.
That's wonderful. What do you hope, Adolf, people who see the photographs, hear the oral histories, what do you hope they're going to take away from paving the way?
A way of life that was taken away. That's my biggest concern right there. You know, because, and I've said this over and over and over, it's not a black thing, it's not a white thing, it's not an Oriental thing, it's not a Mexican thing. If you got to build a highway, you got to build a highway. But at the same time, you took away a way of life. All the churches, all the dentist offices, all the bars, all the restaurants, all the nightclubs, my grandmother's house. Just do a little bit. You don't need to take them all away. And that's what I'm taking away from this is, I tell you, it was just so nice back in the day, as they say. And I was always say this, where your neighbor could spank you if you needed a spanking, you know. those kinds of things. Everybody looked out for everybody. You know, the corner guy at the store would give you credit. You need a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk till payday. And all that's just gone.
Well, the project is paving the way, telling the story of the impact of the construction of I-496 on Lansing's African-American community in the 1960s. And you can find out more by going to lansinghistory.org. And we want to thank Bill Castanier, who's president of the Historical Society of Greater Lansing and longtime Lansing resident walking history book, Adolf Burton. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
As March approaches, more than three quarters of Lake Superior's surface is covered right now in ice, which of course sparks a rather interesting question. How long would it take for a single Zamboni to smooth out all of Lake Superior's ice? We spoke with Bugsy Saylor, a youper from Marquette. He owns the Upper Peninsula Supply Company, and he crunched the numbers.
The calculation that ended up and best estimate I could find was that it takes about 7 minutes to resurface a standard North American ice rink. So then it's a matter of multiplying that by 50 odd million ice rinks, and you can convert that back to just under 700 years to resurface Lake Superior. However, that doesn't take into consideration, you know, any repairs the Zamboni might need, shift change for drivers, and you know, maybe the occasional pickup hockey game.
So no matter if it's Little Caesars Arena or the Mighty Lake Superior, it seems like a hockey game, a pickup hockey game, often gets in the way of a good Zamboni driver.
Well, I went down to the local arena, asked to see the manager man. He came from his office, said, "Son, can I help you?" Looked at him and said,
and that's our show today. I'm Cynthia Candy. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, I want to drive the Zamboni.